Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Kellett. He's executive director of the New England nonprofit organization Restore the Northwoods, which he co-founded in 1992. He's been involved in national park, wilderness, public land, and endangered species issues for more than 30 years. In 1994, he developed a proposal for a 3.2 million acre Maine Woods National Park, which laid the groundwork for the 2016 designation by President Obama of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. In Massachusetts, he has worked to protect Walden Woods and Henry David Thoreau's birthplace and helped to develop legislation introduced in 2019, which would protect state conservation lands from logging and other development. So first off, thank you very much for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
So after our last interview, we had informally discussed the idea of talking about wolf reintroduction into the North Woods, and that's not something I've heard a lot about. You know, we've heard a lot about wolf reintroduction to Yellowstone, which actually was only partial reintroduction since they were on their way there anyway. So can you introduce the North Woods again for listeners, and then after that talk about what they used to be like, what they are like now, what the absence of wolves might mean, and then let's talk about the possibility of reintroducing.
Okay. Well, the North Woods is a term that's used across a large region from Maine to Minnesota, and then there's a comparable region in Canada from Nova Scotia to Manitoba, although they don't call it the North Woods because to them it's the South Woods. But that's really one big ecoregion. There are a lot of smaller sub ecoregions within that, but it's pretty much the interface between the boreal forest to the north and the hardwood forest to the south. And if you go to northern Maine and then you go to the UP, northern Michigan, it looks very similar. You really would hardly know that you'd transported there. So this region, of course, Maine was what really the beginning of the forest products industry in the United States. That because when the settlers came here, they mowed down all the trees in southern New England pretty early on. But northern Maine remained pretty remote and undeveloped for quite a long time. And Henry David Thoreau writes about, even in the mid-1800s, about areas that had where the loggers hadn't gotten there yet. So the Maine woods remained pretty wild until the late 1800s. And the same with northern Minnesota, for example, same kind of thing. Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, which is a lot like northern Maine, remained intact long enough for it to get designated as a wilderness area under public ownership, which is great. Unfortunately, it was too late for Maine and New England because they had all, you know, before the concept of public land even gained traction anywhere here, all the trees were gone. But the good side is that this ecoregion and the ecosystems in it are really extremely resilient. They're amazingly resilient. They're not like lots of parts of the world where if you mow down the forest, you literally have to plant new trees or the whole thing dries up and either blows away or washes away with the next big rains. Here, if you cut the trees down and a new forest grows to take its place. Now, it's not exactly the same as the original forest, of course, but it's amazing how resilient it is. And you can go to areas in the North Woods today that were cut, say, 100 years ago, and it's obviously not an old-growth forest, but it looks pretty primeval. And in fact, I was involved in designating wilderness areas both in Michigan and in Maine on national forest land. And these are areas that 100 years ago, or even less, were basically stump lands where they had, where everything was chopped down, and yet by the 1980s and 90s they qualified as wilderness. So our whole thing is to basically set aside, protect some large areas in this ecoregion, and then let nature take its course, and restore the native biodiversity to the extent we can. We can't do it all. For example, caribou, because of climate change, caribou used to live in the Maine woods, and of course there's a town called Caribou, Maine. Probably today it would be very hard to reestablish caribou, although maybe not impossible, but there was an attempt to reintroduce them back in the 1990s, and they didn't survive, although it's not clear that it was strictly because of habitat. There were other things going on, but so we're trying to the key is to protect as much as possible of the ecosystem, because without protection, you really can't restore a healthy ecosystem. It's not going to happen on private lands to any great degree. People in New England like to think that that we don't need large amounts of public land, and that we can do all this on private land. There's no place where that's happened, so I don't think it's going to happen here.
So before we go on, I'm just really curious. So redwoods grow really quickly, and they also get really big. And then I grew up in Colorado, and an old growth forest in Colorado, the trees, you know, might not be, they'll be pretty magnificent, but they might not be huge. I lived in Nevada for a couple of years, where an old growth forest might be 30 feet tall, you know, if it's bristlecone pine. So, like when you talk about 100-year-old trees, I have no idea. Can you, tell us a couple species, and B, how big would an ancient tree have been 300 years ago, and how big are the 100-year-old trees, and how fast do they grow? I know this is not central to our issue, but I'm really curious.
Well, it's important because most of the trees in the region are less than 100 years old.
Oh, wait, one more thing. I was fortunate enough to go to the Northwest Territories back in 1989, and it was just beautiful to see 500 miles of unbroken forest. It was clearly old growth, but the trees, because it's so cold, the trees were like 30 feet tall. Same deal.
Sorry, like a lot of Alaska. No, a lot of Alaska's like that too, where there are trees. this region, it's not like redwoods, but the original forest, we don't know to a great degree, because there are no scientific surveys of what was there. It's all anecdotal. White pines, the eastern white pines, could grow depending on where you were. And western Massachusetts is actually ecologically a part of the North Woods. In white pines in western Massachusetts could grow to over 200 feet, up to 250 feet sometimes, and live to be 350, 450 years old or more. The hemlocks also can grow to not quite as tall, but pretty tall, you know, several hundred feet, couple hundred feet tall, and live several hundred years. Hardwoods can live, oaks and maples and so forth can live a couple hundred, 250 years maybe or so, and they don't get as tall, but they can get to be, say, 150 feet tall or so. But right now, of course, and you have beech, you have hickory. Hickory is sort of on the southern outskirts of the North Woods. So the core of the North Woods is really beech, maple, and then pine and hemlock and spruce and fir. Now, spruce and fir trees don't get as large. They're not as tall, although, you know, old growth, they can get a couple hundred, close to a couple hundred feet tall, maybe approaching that. So, you know, the original forest was not like going into a redwood forest or into a grove of sugar pines in Oregon or something, but it would have been a pretty impressive forest. And the remnants that are left are pretty amazing. And so, and as far as we can tell based on reconstruction, almost the entire ecoregion was covered in forest. There was very little, there were really not too many openings other than like there were wetlands, there were rocky outcrops. There were, of course, in places like the Adirondacks, there, you know, pretty good sized mountains, and there's Mount Katahdin. So those had, you know, barren areas. You had bogs, and then once in a while there would be a fire, although hardly, very rarely, maybe every couple hundred years an area would burn. But you had blowdown storms, ice storms. But still, most of the region was pretty much solid forest. And there's a famous quotation from Henry David Thoreau standing up. He never was able to get all the way up to the top of Mount Katahdin in Maine because of the weather. It was terrible weather when he tried, but he was up on the side of it looking out, and he talked about it looked like a firm, like a grass sward, grassy, almost like a meadow. It was just solid trees as far as you could see, with ponds and lakes sort of breaking it up. So the original forest was way more lush, you know. And then the other thing is the original forests here, unlike most of the, certainly the Rockies and other regions of the West, although not like Oregon, Northern California, Washington, but really lush, wet, or damp forest floor, and you had all kinds of wildflowers and young trees growing up and fungi. And so it was, a lot of places it was spongy to walk around. And again, one of the things Thoreau, in writing about the Maine woods, he said it's all mossy and moosey. And it's because he was talking about walking around on all this moss that was all spongy. And of course, there were moose all over the place. So because you have a damp, you know, rain is a common thing here. And fire is not common. So the forests were able to pretty much just grow. The oldest forests now, except a few little remnants, are less than 100 years old. Instead of letting them grow, of course, there's a push to cut them down all over again and start all over again. So there'll never be any old growth forests under that scenario.
So we've talked about the plants. Let's talk about the animals. What animals are pretty prevalent there? We'll exclude humans for now. And what animals are missing?
Well, this part of this region, it's not the only region, of course, but the North Woods from Maine to Minnesota and especially in the U.S., a lot of the major wildlife species were all but wiped out when colonists came over from Europe and just shot, you know, all the deer were on the verge of being exterminated in the region. Beaver were totally gone. There were turkeys. They were almost completely wiped out. And of course, all the predators. There were wolves. There weren't coyotes originally. They came to take the place of wolves to take the opportunity to come where wolves had been wiped out by the early 1900s. Lynx, bobcats, fisher, pine marten, all those species were caribou in northern Maine, moose. They were all common species across the region, and they almost all of them were wiped out almost completely. But today, all of those species, except the wolf, are back, and caribou, it's unclear whether they would be able to survive ecologically now. But pretty much all the native species that were here before human, you know, before European settlement are back, except passenger pigeons, and this was not a major part of their territory, so they were really not a major part of the ecosystem. So you pretty much have all the original species back, but it's out of kilter because the predator, another one, it was catamount, mountain lions. They were here too. They're not here. They're not back. So the two major predators were wolves and mountain lions and cougars, and they're gone. There's talk, you know, you hear once in a while of somebody saying they saw a cougar and somewhere in the boonies of northern New England, and it's possible there are a few around, but it's certainly not, there's certainly not a significant population, if any.
So I have a friend who teaches at State University of New York, Binghamton, and mm-hmm. there's a Binghamton has an endowment forest, or they have a forest, and mm-hmm. the forest, my friend just absolutely adores amphibians, and he mm-hmm. gets very agitated because the amphibians are getting hammered because there are too many deer because there aren't any wolves, and So the deer eat the undergrowth and destroy habitat for his beloved amphibians. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering, that's New York. So is it similar in, is there a hyperabundance of deer in Maine because of the lack of mountain lions and wolves?
Yes, and it's not just because of that. There's a double whammy happening. The first part of it is that all the clearing of forest boosted the amount of deer habitat. And once the deer, there used to be market hunting, basically, of deer. So, people just shot deer every time they saw a deer, and that's why deer almost disappeared. But as soon as that was banned, because the deer were almost gone, deer rebounded. And because deer like openings, they like, they don't like deep forests. They will stay in deep forest when it's really snowy, just as, you know, as a nesting place, basically, to rear their young and so forth. But their food supply is in the opening areas, in the edge, forest edge. And so the whole North Woods was loaded with forest edge and still is. And so deer the deer population exploded partly because of that. And then, of course, there were no predators to eat the deer. And part of what predators do too is they disrupt deer behavior. So the deer aren't as comfortable, they can't settle down as much, so that keeps them from reproducing as much too. So it's a double thing where there's too much habitat and there are virtually no predators for deer. And the same with moose in Maine. Maine has more moose than any other state in the lower 48 states. Next to Alaska, it's got the most moose of any state. And there's no predator for moose. So they're dying sometimes from, you know, starvation from eating too much of the food supply, or ticks, or they die from ticks having so many ticks on them that they literally are bled out and die from loss of blood. So it's a big problem. It's a problem across the region. And of course, the other part of this is Lyme disease is a big problem, especially in the eastern part of the region. It isn't as big as you go farther north. It's less and less of an issue because the ticks, it's carried by ticks, and those ticks don't survive as well in those areas. But the Lyme disease ticks are, the vectors of the ticks are deer and white-footed mice, both of which like openings. And so the perverse thing is we have this idiotic concept now of logging for wildlife, because supposedly we don't have enough early successional young forest, which is a totally crazy. And so that they're deliberately clear-cutting forests supposedly for birds, but guess what? It's creating more habitat for deer. So you're increasing the problem even more.
So there's two stories I want to tell about that real quick. One of them is back when I was doing a lot of timber sale appeals back in the 90s, this mm-hmm. used to, which for listeners, that's where the Forest Service puts out a timber sale, and then activists would point out the places where they're lying or where they are breaking laws, and then you attempt to stop the timber sale by pointing out these flaws in it. And one of the things that used to make us so frustrated is that the Forest Service would routinely say that these timber sales are necessary to improve habitat for white-tailed deer. Because, mm-hmm. of course, white-tailed deer, like you said, like the openings, they like the edges. And it's like white-tailed deer populations are exploding and you're destroying habitat for wolverines so you can make more for white-tailed deer. That's one story. And the other one is John Stossel. Do you know who that is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's pretty nasty. He asked me to be on his show one time, and my mom prohibited me from doing it because she said that he was going to twist my words. But I ended up not being on the show. But the assistant asked me a whole bunch of questions for like 2 hours beforehand, and we were talking about forests. And his argument was that forests are in better shape now than they were 300 years ago or 500 years ago. Yeah, exactly. And I said, look, I don't care what arguments he makes. Just please, 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 there's one argument that I'm telling you he cannot use, which is don't say that we need to cut forests to improve white-tailed deer habitat. And then we gave all the reasons that you just gave, that I just gave. And I said, I don't care if you don't hear anything else I say for this entire 2 hours that we've talked. Hear me on this, that don't use that argument. And what do you know what his main argument was? Exactly that. So, yes, I'm just validating that this is a long-term problem, that it's used as an excuse to deforest, and it's just crap.
Well, the thing is, though, people have caught on enough now to the deer issue that they'll mention that because they'll just have a menu of all the species that like clear cuts. But the argument that's being made now mainly is they don't talk much about deer, actually. They talk about songbirds, and they go, oh, the songbird numbers are declining. They've declined precipitously, and that's because there's not enough of that early successional habitat for the songbirds. So we need to save our birds. We need to create more early successional habitat for our birds. And so literally they are clear-cutting mature, they're not old growth, but mature forests. They're clear cutting them supposedly for birds. And they're doing this across the region. They're doing this in New Jersey. They're doing it in Massachusetts. They're doing it all across New England. They're doing it down in Maryland, I know, other places. And of course, it's creating a bunch of deer habitat at the same time. And they just don't really, they'll never answer the question, what about the deer problem? What aren't you making it worse? They just ignore that. But this is a big thing. This is the biggest problem with trying to protect forests in this region right now, other than just pure forest industry wanting, making money, is you have conservation organizations that are opposing forest protection because they claim we need to clear cut forests to create habitat for songbirds. And I've done a lot of looking into this, and it's totally bogus. It's totally bogus.
Instead of destroying the homes for forest-dependent creatures, maybe if you need some early successional forests for them, you can turn suburbs into early successional forests.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just said it. There's plenty of early successional habitat. All you have to do is drive around the region, and you can see it's all over, or fly over. It's everywhere. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's all built on a very weird... You've probably heard about the climate change deniers who claimed that actually the Earth's been cooling. And what they did is they started with 1998, which was a weird, really weird year. I think there was an El Nino or whatever, so it was really unusually warm. And then you'd create a graph, and sure enough, it's gotten cooler. Not very much, but it's gotten cooler since 1998. Well, what they've done I never knew much about this before, but looking into it, it's really weird. They had this breeding bird survey. You've probably heard about that. There's a national breeding bird survey that's done each year. But it didn't start until 1966. Before 1966, there's basically no good data on species other than game species and mammals. And so all this stuff you hear about the birds declining, but it's all since 1966. So what you got is, think about what the state of the forest. The forest was, you had basically old growth natural forest until 1620, when they started mowing them down in New England and across the East. And within a couple hundred years, it was pretty much all gone. You had 80% of Massachusetts was deforested by the mid 1800s. And guess what? All the species that love clear openings did great. There were species that moved in from grassland areas to the west because, of course, their homes were being turned into cornfields. So you had species coming into New England that weren't even native to the region. And this is true in all across the region. And now, because the forests are actually growing back, because the agriculture has declined and the forest industry in this region has declined, and so the trees are growing back. And guess what? That means all this abnormally high amount of early successional habitat is declining. And with it, are the numbers of the early successional birds. And instead of saying, oh, well, this is a natural thing, and isn't it wonderful because now we have more interior bird habitat for all the species that need deep, dark forests and lush undergrowth, they're saying, oh, no, we need to clear cut to boost that habitat. And where it all started is not what you talked about with the U.S. Forest Service. The U.S. Forest Service and the forest industry saw this as a great opportunity to promote more logging. And also what also happened is the industrial hunting interests saw this as an opportunity to boost habitat for grouse and deer and woodcock and turkey and pheasants, which aren't even native to the U.S., And because this creates more habitat for the species they want to shoot. So it's like a win-win between the industry, the agencies, and the hunting interests.
So we're about halfway through, a little bit over halfway. And so let's now move to the primary topic of wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And we've set the stage for it. So wolves are absent, which is one of the causes of one of the many causes of having too many deer and too many moose that cause mm-hmm. harm to moose, deer, mm-hmm. amphibians, interior loving birds. So what would happen? So a few questions. One is, what would happen? I guess you could use Yellowstone as a model if you wanted. What would happen if wolves weren't reintroduced, in your best guess? Two, after the interview last time, you talked about why wolves can't make it on their own and they would have to be reintroduced. So can you talk about that on record? And then the third thing is, how do we do it, and how do we make it happen? How do we facilitate it happening? And what would be the opposition?
To start with, in terms of what wolves would do if they were back here, is they would have a huge food supply, because there's too many deer, too many moose, lots of beaver, and lots of muskrats and other animals that they eat. And so there would be plenty of food for them. They need places to get away from humans. And although southern New England, obviously there are a lot of people in the southern Midwest, but if you go up to far northern Michigan, far northern Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, the Adirondacks, there aren't really very many people. And well, if you dropped wolves in there, like they did in Yellowstone, they would find all kinds of places to get away from people. They'd have plenty of food. This is their native habitat. This is where they lived. And all you have to do is look at the western part of the region in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Their wolves are thriving to the point where retrograde interests have opened up hunting seasons to kill them, because they don't, there's this anti-wolf, bizarre anti-wolf obsession people have. And so they're killing wolves in the western part of the region, but it's the same habitat, the same ecosystem as in the eastern part. The thing that's missing is in the western part, wolves were able to naturally come to from northern Minnesota and also from Canada. They could come down into and repopulate their habitat, and that's what happened. The problem in Michigan is you have the Great Lakes, and there's no way for them to get from the Upper Peninsula to the Lower Peninsula unless they walked across the Mackinac Bridge. So that's a problem. So it's highly unlikely they will ever get there on their own. There's a problem in northern Maine as well, because you've got the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is about 90 miles north of northern Maine, and that's a really major waterway. And because it's used for shipping, they keep it ice free as much as possible, so the wolves really don't have any good way to get across. And the St. Lawrence goes quite a ways for all the way from the ocean, quite a ways west, so it blocks access to northern Vermont and New Hampshire as well. The Adirondacks, potentially wolves could get there, but the wolves are farther away to the north in Algonquin Park, so in Canada, so that's difficult too. So there are some major barriers to them getting to these areas. Now, there once in a while, there a wolf has gotten through. There have been a couple wolves that in Maine that were found dead over the last couple decades. And they had no doubt come down from Canada, but it's that's not enough of a pot. There's not enough of a potential for natural recolonization, I don't think, for that to happen. And it's getting worse as there's more and more development. So I don't think there's much chance without introduction of wolves coming back to New England, or the Adirondacks for that matter. If they were back, they would go crazy. They'd have tons of food, they'd have tons of space. It would really help the ecosystem in a big way.
How would it help? How would it help wolves? I mean, I'm sorry. How would it help
Yeah.
moose? How would it help forests? How would it help forest-dwelling birds, etc.?
Well, a good example actually is Yellowstone, which you mentioned. Yellowstone has about I think the number now is about 150 wolves in Yellowstone National Park itself. And now the Maine Woods National Park that we proposed it would be 3.2 million acres. So it'd be a million acres bigger than Yellowstone. It'd be the size of Yellowstone and Yosemite together. So you could, and the habitat in Maine is way better than the habitat in Yellowstone, because Yellowstone is very high country. A lot of it is really mountainous and inaccessible, and there's not a lot of food supplies. So you could get a lot more wolves in the Maine woods per acre, you know, per 100 acres or whatever, than you can in Yellowstone. So you would have lots of wolves. What would happen is they would start paring down the numbers of moose and deer. And, you know, moose especially, you got all these moose that are sick because of, you know, the tick problem and other things, and there are too many of them, so they're competing for food. A good example is Isle Royale National Park in Michigan. There's been this balancing act between wolves and moose, and they've done studies showing that when the moose numbers get too high, they deforest there, or not deforest, but they devegetate all the vegetation they can reach to eat. And that's what that's what they're doing in the Maine woods, and that's what deer are doing even more in the areas where they live. Deer don't live in the far north. It's too cold. They don't like super deep snow. But in the southern part of the region, there are way too many deer. And so the wolves would, in Yellowstone, what they found is wolves have reduced the number of deer and elk by eating them, and also by, you know, especially in the end, also they help the health of the herd, because they eat, they don't go after healthy adult animals. They go after sick and dying or young and easily caught deer and moose, and out in the west elk. So they basically help to pare down the herd, and so that reduces the amount of herbivory by the deer and moose, that which in turn helps amphibians and other species that need that undergrowth to live in. And that also is important in terms of regeneration of trees, because obviously this trees, you know, seeds and from the trees fall on the ground, but with tons of deer and moose, as soon as the little tree starts growing up, they just nip it right off. They eat it. So the trees don't regenerate either in the forest. And so what would happen, and also in, of course, areas, especially along the coast, it would tend to reduce the amount of Lyme disease, because there would be less habitat for white-footed mice and deer, which are vectors for the Lyme disease tick. So it would improve the whole ecosystem. And again, there have been studies in Yellowstone that have shown that the deer, or the wolf reintroduction there, has had a major positive impact on the ecosystem.
So do people in Maine, I grew up in the West, and I've lived mm-hmm. my entire life in the West, and the attitude, the rural West, even more so, mm-hmm. And the attitude of many people in the West is really summed up by the three S's: shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Right.
And there is this insane and religious, I would say, I don't mean religious like coming from Christians, I mean religious as in dogmatic and faith-based hatred of wolves. And is there, does that exist in, and let's also just mention mountain lions too. Does that mm-hmm. hatred exist in Maine too?
Well, there certainly is some of that, but overall, because those species haven't been around, people have sort of a more distant view of them. And also they've seen what's happened out west. People know about the wolf reintroduction in Yellowstone and so forth. So the biggest resistance, I mean, there is natural resistance amongst the general public, mainly because they're worried that wolves would, you know, they'd be dangerous, which is totally bogus. Or worrying about they'd eat their cat or whatever, which coyotes are a bigger threat in that way than wolves. Wolves are really not a big threat for that kind of, they stay away from people. But other than that, there's really not nearly as much opposition as there is in the West. And also you don't have the ranching industry, which is a hotbed of opposition in the West. That basically doesn't exist in the East. And now you do have the hunting, the traditional hunting community, which is, if you talk to individual hunters, a lot of them are actually fairly reasonable about it and are pretty open-minded. But the organized hunting industry and also the agency people in the state agencies are all totally against wolves. And so they help to prime the pump against wolves, and the general public, they don't really know that much about it, so they're sort of not engaged. But there have been, when we Restore the North Woods proposed reintroduction of Maine of wolves to New England, especially Maine, back in the 1990s, and we were surprised at how positive actually the response was. Even I remember doing a talk up in Machias, Maine, which is way down east in Maine. And, the audience was loaded with these guys with orange vests on. And, they didn't look like the natural constituency for wolves. Yet, I did a straight presentation as to why it made sense to reintroduce wolves and what, all the things we've been talking about. And, there were a few hostile people, but actually most of the people asked reasonable questions, and they were not nasty or hostile, and they actually, overall they were, I think at the end, it was at the University of Maine, Machias, so there was a professor from the university who sort of oversaw the thing, and he asked for a show of hands, how many people would at least consider wolf recovery, and more people raised their hands than didn't. So I think a lot of it is that people, the conservation community assume that everyone's going to be against wolves. And there certainly is a lot of anti-wolf sentiment, but I think a lot of it is just people, lack of knowledge and a few narrow interest groups representing really not very many people are calling the shots. And we need to, I think Yellowstone's a good example. Yellowstone, it was a national park, and basically the response was, too bad, if you guys don't like it, tough. There's no hunting in Yellowstone. You guys know this is public land, this is a national park. Too bad, if you don't like it, we're going to do it anyway. And so the wolves were reintroduced, and look, it's super popular, as you know, I'm sure. That's one of the major draws of Yellowstone, wolves and bison. So I actually am very positive about the potential. It's just that you're working against a lot of resistance in the system, especially from the state agencies. They're horrible. The state wildlife agencies are totally retrograde. These guys are not helpful. There are some good people in the agencies, but the agency overall, they tend to just cater to the industrial hunting industry, and they're anti-predator. And there's this stupid idea that, if you have too many, you have wolves, they're going to eat my deer that I could shoot. Driving along in my pickup truck, I can just open the window and shoot one without getting out. And I don't want those wolves eating them. And it's just really stupid. But most people, especially in this region, that's not what they're thinking. And in fact, I really think if we had wolves in the region, what would happen is they would end up coming down to Massachusetts. They come out to Western Massachusetts, where there's actually quite a bit of open space, and there's the Quabbin Reservoir. And I think people would, there'd be a little bit of hesitation, but I think people would actually find that this is a really cool thing. So I still am very positive about the possibility. It's just that it takes, we're a small group, and it takes a lot of effort to overcome this institutional obstruction.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and one of the reasons, honestly, and I know I live way out here, and I'm throwing this all on you, but mm-hmm. one of the reasons I wanted to do this particular interview is to plant a seed or to switch metaphors to try to jumpstart some sort of movement to reintroduce those predators. So, mm-hmm. so how would that take place? What would people, let's say there is somebody listening to this who lives in Maine, and this is, I know you've got your hands full with all your stuff. Let's say there's somebody else who lives in Maine, loves wolves, and is looking for something to do. How would one begin a program? How would one begin a campaign to reintroduce, and let's not leave mountain lions out of it, to reintroduce mountain lions and wolves to right. Maine? How would that work? What would they do? What would they need to do?
Well, the biggest issue is public education, because the public doesn't know much about this, and Restore was doing a lot of public education, but we can't do everything, and we ended up working on other issues, and there's been sort of tacit support for the idea from other organizations, but not really any active group that had the resources in Maine to carry it forward. So right now the issue is sort of just floating out there. So education and outreach is really critical. But the other part is, even if we got approval to reintroduce wolves like a la Yellowstone in the Maine woods, they would all be dead in short order, because there's no Yellowstone in New England. That's why we need a Maine Woods National Park. We need a big national park area where wolves would be safe, where it's illegal to go after them, where there are very few roads, and that's how we were able to bring wolves back to the Northern Rockies. Is Yellowstone was a safe haven. That's what we need, and we need to protect some big areas in New England that same way. So we need to educate people about wolves, but until we have safe habitat for them, it actually restoring them is not a good thing for the wolves, because they're going to end up dead. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just means we need to do both of those things. The same with mountain lions. The same thing. They need the same kind of habitat, remote areas where they're not going to get shot and killed and trapped and so forth.
There's two things I want to say about both of those. One of them is that about mountain lions, where I live, I've never seen them myself. I've seen prints. I've never in my life seen a mountain lion. But they live in the neighborhood where I live, mm-hmm. and occasionally somebody in the neighborhood will freak out and send an alert to everybody in the neighborhood saying, "Oh my God, there's a mountain lion." But they don't. I mean, there's no. I live at sort of the urban, not I mean urban. It's Crescent City, California. It's a tiny little mm-hmm. town. Mm-hmm. But I live where sort of nature meets a very very small town, mm-hmm. and the mountain lion doesn't do anything. There's no, I mean, it might take some cats, but it hasn't killed anybody's children. It's
right.
I've never even seen them, and I've lived here 20 years and,
right.
and I have no doubt. I mean, people have seen them within about 50 yards of my home.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so mountain lions are nothing to be afraid of. I just want to say that for everybody.
Right.
And
right.
the other one is an advantage that they had in Yellowstone for the reintroduction is that, as I said earlier, the wolves were coming down on their own anyway, and so the politicians in Idaho, McClure, who's a horribly anti-environmental politician,
right.
Was one of the proponents of wolf reintroduction, and the reason is because if they reintroduce them, the population would be considered experimental and not get full Endangered right. Species Act protection. So right. my point is that the wolves themselves, in that case, forced the issue.
Right. Right.
And that's not an advantage you're going to have there for the reasons you said at right. St. Lawrence, that the wolves are not going to be able to force the issue, which means humans are going to have to force the issue.
Exactly. Exactly. And the thing, our whole, I mean, this is the Michael Soule approach. The great ecologist, Michael Soule, he talks about, you know, keystone predators, and he basically, you know, and he's not the only one, but the idea is that if you create habitat in a safe harbor for the top predators like wolves and mountain lions and so forth, grizzly bears out west, we have black bears in the east, then all the species below on the food chain are also taken care of, and our that's. But if you don't have large protected areas, doesn't matter what you do, you're never going to be able to fully protect these species. And so, like mountain lions, the you know, you have remnant populations that never were wiped out in the West. In the East, they really were wiped out. I'm sure there were no mountain lions anywhere in the eastern United States, or, you know, northeastern United States at some point. There may be a few individuals that come down from Canada or whatever now, but you know, that's not really a viable population. And even when they do, they get hit by a car, they get shot, whatever, and they can't find mates. So that's why we need big protected areas, and that's why Restore has focused so much on new national parks and wilderness and so forth. Is without that, all these other things are only patchwork fixes that are not permanent. And on the other hand, if you have these large protected areas and you can reconstruct as much as you can the original pieces by putting, you know, putting wolves back, putting mountain lions back, you got black bear, you got the other species, the ecosystem is going to take care of itself if we just leave it alone and let it rewild. So that's the key, I think, in the it's not just in the Northeast there. As you know, there are lots of places in the West that also have been damaged that need to be protected and rewilded.
And, well, I'm going to say four things. Three of them are habitat, habitat, habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth one is sometimes, I mean, I keep thinking about the difficulty wolves have of getting in there. Yeah. Of getting to Maine, and sometimes right. Nature does need our help, but mainly, no, that's not a pun, but mainly it can you end, we have like 1 minute left, can you end by, let's say that you do help a little bit, and let's say you protect it, and then a really important concept that you introduced last radio interview mm-hmm. was, I don't know if we call it afforestation or afforestation.
Proforestation.
I thought you called it afforestation.
No, afforestation is planting trees where there were no trees. Proforestation is letting the trees grow back.
Well, I'm glad I brought this up because I've been, for the last 4 months, I've been promoting the wrong thing. I've been promoting the wrong word.
Well, afforestation is good too. But if you mean letting existing forests grow back, not cutting them down and letting them grow back and mature to reach their full potential, that's proforestation. That's a newly coined term. Yes.
Okay, so can you do 30 seconds on, because that ties everything you're talking about together,
yep.
on protect habitat and then talk about proforestation.
Well, I think there is, you're right. There, the issue of humans supposedly helping nature, I think we should just get out of the way for the most part. I think in most cases, humans are just screwing things up. We think we know so much, we don't know what we're doing. So wherever possible, we should just let proforestation restore the forest, and a lot of the species will recover on their own. Unfortunately, there are a few missing species because humans have created barriers like the St. Lawrence Seaway, and they can't get back on their own. And in those cases, I think humans do need to help because it's beneficial to the ecosystem and so forth. So the number one is let nature take its course wherever possible. This management garbage has got to go. It doesn't make any sense for most part. And then if they're missing major predators, we may need to help them come back, but we ought to do as little as possible and let them go. And the main thing is they need a safe haven where they can reproduce and live their lives and be a part of the ecosystem.
Well, thank you so much for saying all that, and thank you so much for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Kellett. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.